Hey, it's Meg, and I have something really exciting to tell you. A few months ago, when I first spoke with Kelly Mahler, she suggested we work together to do something really big to totally disrupt the OT and SLP fields, launching us even further into neurodiversity affirming practice. And I was really into that idea, because I know that this is truly aligned with the therapist that most of us wanted to be when we started our journeys into our fields. So, Learn, Play, Thrive is hosting a continuing education summit, one for OTs, one for SLPs. We have a really impressive, impactful, and neurodiverse panel of speakers for both summits. Between the two summits, there are going to be talks on the neurodiversity paradigm, interoception, energy regulation, strengths-based goal writing, AAC, working with kids who learn language through scripting, disability justice and race, emergent literacy, both in terms of writing development and reading comprehension, and so much more. If you want the exact right place to start or continue your journey into neurodiversity affirming practice, this is the summit for you. It will be registered for CEUs with both ASHA and AOTA, and will provide so many opportunities for you to connect with each other and with the speakers in live question and answer sessions, because I want you to truly feel the support of your community in this transformative process. So come get your CEUs, build your skills and confidence, meet your people, and totally transform your work. The SLP Summit is in October of 2022, and the OT Summit is in January of 2023. Check out the details at learnplaythrive.com/summit. Welcome to the Two Sides of the Spectrum podcast, a place where we explore research, amplify autistic voices, and change the way we think about autism in life and in our professional therapy practices. I'm Meg Proctor from learnplaythrive.com. Before we get started, a quick note on language. On this podcast, you'll hear me and many of my guests use identity-affirming language. That means we say autistic person rather than person with autism. What we're hearing from the majority of autistic adults is that autism is a part of their identity that they don't need to be separated from. Autism is not a disease. It's a different way of thinking and learning. Join me in embracing the word autistic to help reduce the stigma. Welcome to episode 50 on Disability Justice with Lydia X. Z. Brown. Today, we are re-airing episode 3 of the podcast because this is such an important topic. Disability justice has come up a few times in the last couple of episodes, and both listeners and my podcast guests have reminded me that the conversation on disability justice has to truly center intersectionality, meaning the experiences and needs of people who are multiply marginalized, for instance, queer and BIPOC disabled folks. Today on the podcast, I have autistic attorney and activist Lydia X. Z. Brown here to talk about autism and race and why this conversation should be at the front of our minds in our actual work on the ground as therapists. I'll tell you about Lydia. They are an attorney and disability justice advocate who specifically focuses on violence against multiply marginalized disabled people. Lydia teaches at Georgetown University's Disability Studies Program, supports the Autistic Women and Non-Binary Network Public Policy Advocacy. Lydia founded and directs the Fund for Community Reparations for Autistic People of Color's Independence, Survival, and Empowerment. And they co-edited All the Weight of Our Dreams, which is an anthology of writing and artwork by autistic people of color. Lydia is also policy counsel for disability rights at the Center for Democracy and Technology. And this is exciting. Lydia is running for Maryland State legislature. I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to donate to their campaign. This is really, really important, and they're doing such good work. So Lydia is also one of the speakers in our upcoming SLP and OT Continuing Education Summits, where they will be giving a talk called Beyond Treatment and Service Provision, Disability Justice for Our Futures and Our Freedom. And they'll also be hosting a live one-hour question and answer session. So you can ask questions and interface directly with Lydia, which is a really exciting opportunity. I'm really excited to reshare this podcast episode. One thing I'll tell you is that Lydia thinks fast and understands systems of power and oppression deeply. So this conversation moved through a lot of content at a really quick pace. You'll hear throughout the episode that I am going to walk you through the interview and reflect on some of what Lydia says, breaking it down a bit more and tying it into our therapy practices. Here's Lydia.
Hi, Meg. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So I just ran through a few of your professional highlights, but tell us a little bit about you as a person and how you came into this work.
I began doing advocacy work probably in high school or even earlier than that, although I wouldn't have necessarily used that word or that terminology. I've believed for a very long time, since I was a young child, that every single one of us has a moral responsibility to use whatever resources we have against injustice and oppression in all of their forms. And of course, I recognize that resources means different things. It can mean time, money, skills, knowledge, energy, emotional capacity. It can mean all of those things are resources. And what resources somebody has may fluctuate throughout their lifetime or from moment to moment, and will look different at different points and in different contexts. But whatever resources somebody has above and past what they need to minimally live a decent existence, to be able to feel okay with themselves and their life, if you have resources past that, then I believe we have a moral obligation to use those resources to disrupt, divest, and end oppression and injustice.
One of the things we'll talk a lot about on the podcast is the strengths that often come with being autistic. Many autistic people have such a clear, convicted sense of justice and are both uninhibited and determined in their journey to fight against oppression. This was clearly something that Lydia felt strongly for such a long time. And if you look Lydia up online, you'll be blown away by both the volume and depth of Lydia's work. Since Lydia specifically centers multiply marginalized disabled people in the work that they do, I asked Lydia to talk about why race matters for therapists working with autistic people. Here's what Lydia said.
In the world that we live in, and in particular here in the United States, where most of us that are listening to this podcast are probably located, it's impossible to exist in the world without your existence being marked by race and by processes of racialization. The entire United States was built on a bedrock of theft and hoarding of land and resources from Native peoples, from Black peoples, later from Latinx, from Southern American indigenous peoples, from Asian peoples. And that has continued today, and the legacies of white supremacy have always continued and affect people of color's lives now. And unfortunately, the way that white supremacy works is that it simultaneously defines the norm, the ideal, and the baseline based upon white people, while devaluing, harming, excluding, and attempting to destroy the lives and existence of negatively racialized people, what we often call people of color. So when we talk about disability and when we talk about autism, we have to understand that both abledness, that is being counted as non-disabled, as neurotypical, as sane, as functional, as healthy, as normal, is coded with whiteness. And at the same time, to be disabled, disabledness is coded as against whiteness as well. That is, when white people are disabled, their disability under white supremacy detracts from their same ability to benefit in the same way from white supremacy. And yet, their whiteness means that of all disabled people, white disabled people are the ones who are most seen as deserving of support, of services, of accommodations, of respect.
I want to pause and unpack some of this. I want to talk about a term Lydia used, negatively racialized. So the term racialized means that race is not something inherent. It's a cultural construct. And within a white supremacist society, race is assigned to various groups by the white people with the most power. When Black slaves were brought to the U.S., they became Black for the first time. Today and throughout history, when immigrants arrive to the U.S., they're categorized. A light-skinned person of German ethnicity is probably going to be considered white. A dark-skinned person from Ghana will likely be considered Black. This has happened since white people arrived in the Americas. Of course, many racialized people have affinity and identity within their racialized group, but the distinctions remain socially constructed and are often used to wield power. These categories are also subject to change. Italian Canadians used to be considered non-white, but now they are almost universally recognized as white. White people are racialized too, but brown, black, and indigenous people are negatively racialized in our society. They are put into a category and then oppressed on the basis of that category. So Lydia is saying that white disabled people still benefit from white privilege, even though they often lack the same access to participation in their lives and in society as non-disabled white people. Here's more of the conversation.
When most people think about disability, they think only about white disabled people. And that's true, even for many disabled people of color, because of the world in which we live. And we are conditioned to treat whiteness as the norm. So when people think, oh, let's talk about how to help autistic kids in school, they are assuming that the group of autistic kids they're talking about are white autistic kids. Now, simultaneously, when people of color, whether Black, brown, indigenous, Asian, or mixed race, are disabled, our disabilities are held against us under white supremacy and used as reasons to accentuate our supposed inferiority, the reasons why we are less than human. And we know throughout history that ableism, that is, discriminatory and oppressive values and practices about disability and about which kinds of people's bodies and minds are valuable as opposed to which are expendable or disposable. Ableism is part of every other form of oppression and oppressive thinking. And what that looks like is the deployment strategically of disability labels and diagnoses as a means of controlling, subjugating, and furthering other forms of oppression against other oppressed, marginalized, and targeted communities.
Can you say more about what that means?
The idea that to be impoverished, that is to be someone who is in your generation low or no income, or especially to be generationally impoverished, is a result of irresponsibility or laziness or stupidity, is not just a core part of class oppression and capitalist ideology, but it's also deeply ableist, because what it communicates is the idea that you are poor because you were inadequate or insufficient. And simultaneously, under white supremacy, when disabled people of color are actually disabled, that is used as evidence of our inferiority. And even if we are not actually disabled, we are often assumed to be disabled or to be inferior simply because of the ways our brains and bodies work, even if disability itself isn't strictly part of the equation. And that traces its way throughout history, whether it's in looking in the 1800s at the way that Chinese immigrants were always talked about as dirty and contamination, and how that rhetoric translated very easily into the 21st century with the first SARS outbreak, which was referred to in a very deja vu way as a novel coronavirus originating from Guangzhou province in China. And now we hear the news over the last several months saying there is a new novel coronavirus that originated in Wuhan, China. And that East Asian people in general, but Chinese people in particular, are seen as this contaminant, something dirty, and how people talk about a clean Chinese restaurant versus a dirty Chinese restaurant, and the assumption that Chinese restaurants in particular are these dirty places. you can look at specifically the ways in which enslaved Black people were labeled as mentally ill with a diagnosis like drapetomania for wanting to be free, for wanting to escape enslavement. And white slaveholders and their allies said if a Black person who was enslaved wished to be free, that was a mental illness. So throughout history, regardless of the particular axis of marginalization, logic of ableism has always been deployed as part and parcel with white supremacy, with colonialism, with classism, with all other forms of oppression in some way or another. So when people ask me today, what does race have to do with autism? The answer is it has everything to do with autism, because you do not work with or talk to or exist around autistic people somehow devoid of race. If they are white autistic people, their race absolutely shapes the world they live in, how they are perceived. The fact that they are most likely to be seen as someone who needs help, even if that's an incredibly condescending way, rather than someone who is Black, Brown, or Indigenous, and in many cases an Asian as well, and sometimes mixed race people, where instead the reaction is you are a burden, you are a drain, you are a problem to be managed, handled, contained, or controlled, or you are a threat, you are a danger.
Okay, so we know that as non-autistic people, we won't ever know what it's like to exist in the world as autistic. We'll never feel the daily burden of ableism, a world that values one way of thinking and being over all others. And those of us who are white know that we will never truly understand the experience of an autistic child who is Brown, Black, Indigenous, or Asian. Where we fall short is recognizing our own biases, as well as systematic, systemic, structural, and institutional oppression, and how they play out for our clients. Those of us who have spent any time at all doing anti-racist work know that we can't just choose to be not racist. Instead, we must acknowledge how deeply embedded racism is in both our society and in ourselves, and then we must fight against it. So it's worth spending a good bit of time with Lydia's question. How might we see our Black, Brown, and Indigenous clients as a problem, a threat, a danger? How might we view the same situation differently for a white child? How might a teacher, a school system, a police officer, a disability evaluator, or 1,000 other people who make decisions about our lives look at that child differently, give them different options, different therapies, different consequences? I wanted to hear more from Lydia about this. So I asked Lydia how the experiences of autistic people of color are different from those of white autistic people.
With regard to autism, but also other disabilities, people of color are both much more likely to be over-identified as disabled when we're not necessarily actually disabled in a particular way, based on racist and ableist ideas about our existence in the world. And we're simultaneously significantly less likely to be identified as autistic or having another disability because of, again, ableist and racist ideas about who we are, how we exist in the world, and the assumption of most people that autism, like other disabilities, is primarily a white person thing or not really a thing. And in the case of autism, this is gendered as well, where a lot of people just assume that autism is a white boy thing. So if you are a girl or you are non-binary, then you are excluded from that equation as well. And what that means in practice is that when we've been in school, the ways that our teachers treat us, the ways that our classmates treat us are invariably and inevitably shaped by their assumptions about our race and about our disabilities. And there are a lot of common experiences that autistic people across race talk about, but the ways that they end up look very different.
Okay, if you're someone who likes data, there is so much data to back up what Lydia is saying. Until 2010, white children were about 19% more likely than Black children and 65% more likely than Latinx children to be diagnosed as autistic. Black and Latinx children got their diagnoses much later than white kids, too. There's a persistent gap in diagnoses and access to services across socioeconomic classes. Newer data shows this may be closing, but it's too soon to tell for sure. Meanwhile, Black children, especially boys, are more likely to be diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder and, anecdotally, may be more likely to be treated as having behavior problems rather than sensory needs or different learning needs. The impact of systemic racism cannot be underestimated here. I asked Lydia to talk about how racism and trauma impact the experiences of disabled people of color, especially children.
Most of us in the autistic community agree that virtually all autistic people have survived one or more forms of trauma. It's an unfortunate in-joke that many of us have talked about with each other that probably all of us have some form of PTSD or another. What many people don't realize outside of some communities of color is that there's even been psychological research on the phenomenon of race-based stress. That is, experiencing racism as a specifically recurring, traumatizing experience. That living in a world that is profoundly racist as a person of color causes trauma. Trauma is itself a kind of disability. And so disabled people of color experience not just the trauma of living in an ableist world, but the trauma of living in a racist world. And the compounded trauma of living in a world where people are both ableist and racist at the same time in ways that intermix and are impossible to extricate or separate. And that does something to you.
We hear more and more about trauma-informed OT practice. So many of our clients have trauma histories. So we need to keep trauma in the front of our minds for each child we work with. And for those of us who don't have a strong trauma-informed practice, this is a great place to start to grow and expand so that we can better serve our clients. And as Lydia points out, we need to expand our understanding of trauma to include race-based stress and recurring experiences of racism. So I asked Lydia to talk a bit more about police violence and the presence of police in our communities to help us better understand the experiences of trauma experienced by people on the receiving end of systematic racism.
I've heard organizers from HEARD, Helping Educate to Advance the Rights of Deaf Communities, estimate that based on available information, both that is officially collected, usually in very ableist and racist ways, and from community information that is not studied by people who would be looked upon as having an academic credential per se, because we often know things in community that are not in a peer-reviewed academic journal, but we know that and we understand it as community knowledge. I've heard them estimate that upwards of 80% of people who were killed by police and people who are incarcerated are disabled in one or more ways. What that means is that if you are Black or Native in this country and you are also disabled, then you are at the highest risk of being targeted for state violence through criminalization. And I want to be very clear here. My positionality is as an East Asian person of color who's also disabled. I do not belong to a group of people that writ large is targeted en masse for police and carceral violence. But what I do know is that those of us who live at the intersections of multiple marginalizations will always be at higher risk than those who experience more intersecting layers of privilege. And for some of us, that's complicated. There are a lot of ways in which I'm very privileged. There are a lot of ways in which I experience significant marginalization. I'm not one of the people that is most likely to be targeted for horrific police violence. But my community members, many of whom are trans women, many of whom are sex workers or do other criminalized work, many of whom are Black or are Native, are. And I believe it's my responsibility to support and amplify their work and their voices in challenging that particularly destructive form of white supremacy and of ableism.
One thing I've seen in the schools is the presence of armed police officers, increasingly in schools that are mostly Black. And we see in the news all the time where Black autistic kids are treated as criminals for actions that would be treated very differently if police officers weren't in schools and likely if the child were white or non-autistic. Can you say anything about the presence of police in schools and school to prison pipeline?
Police don't belong in schools, but the bigger problem is that police don't belong in society.
Did you hear that? Lydia says, police don't belong in schools. Police officers in schools handcuff, arrest, and charge kids for breaking school rules, for fighting, not listening, and even breaking the dress code. Black students and disabled students are arrested, restrained, and secluded at alarmingly disproportionate rates compared to white and non-disabled students. I'll link to some data in the show notes, but here are the highlights. Black students make up around 16% of the student population, but account for 31% of arrests. And restraint, seclusion, and involuntary confinement are used far more commonly on disabled students than on non-disabled students, with Black students overrepresented here as well. The racist police force that we are fighting in the streets is simply duplicated inside of schools. In the wake of recent protests, Denver, Colorado even announced that they are removing all police officers from their schools. Okay, so on to Lydia's next point. Police don't belong in society. I actually agree with Lydia on this point, but you may or may not agree here. It's a big leap to make and hard to imagine a society that you haven't seen before. And it takes a lot of work and a lot of analysis to start to see that prisons and police may not be here to keep us safe, but rather to maintain systems of power and privilege. For the first time, we're seeing mainstream communities calling to defund the police and instead have trained mental health professionals respond to many calls. Are police really the best people to respond to the majority of 911 calls, which relate to drug and alcohol issues, interpersonal disputes, and mental health crises? I'll link to some resources in the show notes if this is something you want to keep thinking about and learning more about. But even if you disagree, it's worth considering from an occupational justice lens. If prisons are systematic occupational deprivation targeting Black, impoverished, and disabled people above all others, what is our position on this as a profession? And taking it back a step further, how do we move closer to a society where systems of oppression and trauma no longer exist? And until we get there, how do we protect Brown, Black, and Indigenous disabled people and ensure they have access to autonomy and respect? I want to hear from you. Each month in my Facebook group, Learn, Play, and Thrive, Autism Resources for Professionals, we talk about some of the hot issues from the podcast. I'll link to the group in the show notes. Join me there to share your perspective and learn from others. So to wrap up my talk, I asked Lydia one final question. Given that many of us will never personally understand what it means to be an autistic person of color in this world, what is one action that you would like to see people who work with autistic kids taking in our lives or in our own work?
Whenever any person, which includes me, does work that affects communities to which we do not belong, we have a responsibility to the people in those communities to do our best to educate ourselves to the extent possible and to actually divert and redistribute resources of all kinds, going back to that earlier comment, to people who belong to those communities. So if you have access to research funding, are there actual autistic people of color that are getting that research funding? Are they doing so on a level that shows parity with the people who are white and degreed, who already had experience accessing that money? If you are designing a program to benefit students in middle school, are there actual middle school students, especially the autistic students of color, that have an actual decision-making role in designing what that program looks like and what its goals are, or even whether it should exist in the first place? If you're teaching other people who are entering the field, whose work are you using to teach with? Who do you hold up as examples? For example, do you read the work of Sarah Salvaggia Hernandez, who is autistic and native and an OT and a professor? And for me, it always comes back to a question of how do you use privilege, if you have privilege or access to it, to challenge the structures that create such severe power imbalances that they would destroy lives? How do you use your position in a school to advocate for cutting all funding to police to begin with? Because police should not exist in a just society. Prisons cannot exist in a just society. Involuntary and coercive treatment cannot exist in a just society. And yet it is people in the OT profession and professions that are related to the OT profession who are often at the very front of fights to say, well, we need to subject children to certain activities or treatments because it's for their own good. We know what is best for them. Or who will even say, yes, we need to reform the criminal legal system by putting more funding in the hands of social workers or mental health workers without understanding the horrific ableist and racist violence that has happened historically and happens today in social services, in mental health care, in hospitals, in all of the supposed helping professions. And for those who are working in this field who are thinking, okay, great, well, you may have just told me that me and my whole field are awful. What do you mean? The answer is, it is not that you have to be awful. The opportunity and the offering to you is, what can you do to challenge the violence of the field that you are in and to reduce your capacity for individual harm, because we all have capacity to harm, and to maximize your capacity to do right by the people that you work with.
Thank you so much, Lydia. Where can we find you online to keep learning from you and your work?
My homepage is at autistichoya.net. I'm migrating some of my information to a new homepage at lydiaxzbrown.com. You can also find me on Twitter and on Facebook using the username autistichoya.
I'll link to all of Lydia's info in the show notes. To wrap things up today, I just want to echo Lydia's question. How do we use our position and our power as OTs? Does our work lead to more of the status quo? Or do we use our position to amplify the voices of those who are systematically ignored and disempowered? Lydia gave some great examples of how to do this. We can highlight autistic voices in our research and in our education. We can question the presence and the actions of police in our schools and advocate for our autistic clients' right to autonomy over their bodies. And we can examine whether our treatments are empowering or coercive. If the last one has you stumped, please keep listening. We're going to tackle that here on the podcast in so many ways. Thanks for listening to the Two Sides of the Spectrum podcast. Visit learnplaythrive.com/podcast for show notes, a transcript of the episode, and more. And if you learned something today, please share the episode with a friend or post it on your social media pages. Join me next time, where we will keep diving deep into autism.